I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
A huge car bomb outside the Australian embassy in Jakarta, Indonesia, has left at least 8 people dead and more than 160 more wounded in the same busy commercial district where the Marriott Hotel was bombed last year. The blast comes just 2 days before the anniversary of the September 11th attacks and just a few weeks ahead of elections in Indonesia and Australia, whose current leaders are among the strongest supporters of President Bush's war on terror. Well, joining us on the line from Jakarta is Deputy Reuters Bureau Chief Dean Yates. And Dean, what are police saying about this bombing? Has anyone claimed responsibility?
Gail, no one has claimed responsibility, but police are clearly pointing a finger at Jemaah Islamiyah, which is a militant Islamic group with links to al-Qaeda. They are saying that this bombing bears all the hallmarks of Jemaah Islamiyah and that the modus operandi is very similar to the attacks at the Marriott Hotel in Jakarta last year, which killed 12 people, and also the Bali bomb attacks 2 years ago, which killed 202 people. So the police seem quite convinced of who is behind it. The Australian government is saying the same thing, as are the Indonesian government. So there seems to be quite a unanimous view on who did this.
And why Australia as a target? The Australian embassy, perhaps I should be a little more explicit, other than the fact that it's easier to hit than the American embassy, which is much farther back from the road.
It's a good question. Certainly in this part of the world, Australia is the most vocal backer of Washington's policies in Iraq. Australia has also been very critical in the past of Indonesian efforts to crack down on extremism in this country. So again, that makes it, that you could argue that that would make it a high profile target.
And what about the Australian elections next month? Because as we know, Australian troops are evidently supposed to remain in Iraq for as long as needed, according to the Prime Minister John Howard. And how much is that a factor?
Yeah, it's probably hard to say, but I guess some people would argue that, as we saw in Spain with the attacks in Madrid, that clearly had an impact on the elections there. Some people might argue that this is an attempt to try to drive a similar wedge within the Australian electorate, with the elections only 1 month away. Again, it's very hard to point clearly in that direction, but it is possible.
And what about the Indonesian elections? They're coming up on September 20th as well.
Yes, I guess with Indonesia, a lot of people here will tell you that one bomb attack in Jakarta is probably not going to have a huge impact on the Indonesian election. For most Indonesian voters who really live in rural areas, this sort of thing is not a big thing for them. What matters for them is the economy, the price of food, corruption, that sort of stuff. But of course, the target may have been the Australian embassy, but the people who have really suffered the most are ordinary Indonesians. And so that really does create a sense of outrage here and frustration. One thing that will be very interesting to find out will be whether this was indeed a suicide bomb attack, because if it was, it would suggest that, like the Marriott attack and like the Bali attacks, this militant group, Jemaah Islamiyah, is prepared to go to any lengths to carry out attacks.
Mm. And how widely supported is Jemaah Islamiyah?
It's clearly an extremist group on the fringes, and the vast majority of Indonesians are moderate Muslims, and they have a moderate outlook. The big problem that the government has here sometimes is actually getting Indonesians to believe that this organization exists. There is, in some quarters here, a sense of denial, if you like, about the existence of Jemaah Islamiyah. Part of the problem is that the name translates in Indonesia into Islamic community. So you go around branding an organization called Islamic community. A lot of Indonesians, you know, may just see that that's tarring a lot of Muslims with the same brush.
Mm. Well, Dean Yates, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem, Gail.
Dean Yates is Deputy Bureau Chief for the Reuters News Agency in Jakarta, Indonesia. many foreign aid agencies are beginning to evacuate their international staff from Iraq after two Italian women were kidnapped this week. The women work for the Italian agency Bridge to Baghdad. They and two Iraqis are still being held hostage after a group of armed men stormed their Baghdad office on Tuesday. Marco Buono works for the Italian agency Intersos in Iraq. He was out of the country when the kidnapping happened and joins us on the line from Rome. And Marco, I understand that you both lived and worked with the Italian women who were kidnapped.
Actually, I was based in the same building as the two Italian ladies were, and we were just sharing all the office facilities and living together. Yes, that's correct.
Any idea why they may have been a target?
I can imagine, yes, because first of all, because they are Italians.
And the Italian government was a supporter of the war in Iraq?
Yes, that's correct.
Are you angry that that these people coming in, trying to be helpful, trying to make the situation better, are being targets?
I'm angry, but I'm not surprised, because I know that in Iraq there are organizations that doesn't like activities like the ones we do, because what we are trying to do in Iraq is just to help to build up a democratic society and to build up what we call a civil society. And these people that is fighting us, they don't have in their agenda any democratic process. They just want probably to get they wish to get the power, but they are, of course, they are not ready for a democratic style of power.
And do you think we are now at a point when international agencies are going to say it is just too dangerous for anyone foreign-born to continue working in Iraq?
For some time, probably, we will call all the people out from the country. I mean expat people, but just temporarily. We have relocated, for instance, our international personnel or in Amman or in Kuwait City. And they will stay over there for probably a few weeks. But as soon as we believe the situation is okay, they will go back into the country.
Can you give us a little sense of what kind of work Intersos does?
Yes, we work especially with refugees. We work in collaboration with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and we are busy with both with refugees from other countries present in Iraq, like Iranian, for instance, or at the same time we work with returnees, people, Iraqi people that are still abroad and they want to come back to Iraq.
Well, what about after this latest kidnapping? Are they continuing with their work, or are they pretty frightened at this point?
Of course they are frightened, but they are still working. It's part of the job. I mean, not only army people are courageous people.
Marco, we certainly join you in hoping for their swift and safe return and for the safety of all your workers.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Marco Buono of the Italian non-governmental organization Intersos. Editors of some of the world's top medical journals have laid down the law. Anyone who wants to publish a clinical study in the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, Lancet, and nine other journals must now make the existence of that study public before the results are known. That's because, these editors say, too many studies with negative results never see the light of day. For more, we're joined by Dr. Gregory Kerfman, executive editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Kerfman, welcome.
Thank you, Gail.
And tell us, why the new rule?
Well, it's become increasingly clear that some clinical trials, and particularly ones funded by some of the pharmaceutical companies, when the results are not favorable to the company, have not been published, and the results don't see the light of day, and they're buried away. What it results in is a biased reporting of results in a positive direction.
So all we're hearing now are the success stories, but if a trial doesn't show a benefit for a certain drug, why does it really matter if we never hear about it again?
Well, it's not just that it may not show a benefit. There may actually be adverse side effects that may not then be known to the community. There may actually be dangers that are being buried away. So it's very important that when a clinical trial be conducted, that its results be made public.
The pharmaceutical industry announced its own voluntary trials database this week. What about that? Is that enough? Does that meet your standards?
I think that it may be well-intentioned, but a voluntary reporting system is not going to be adequate. Indeed, some members of Congress have expressed an interest in actually developing a bill that hopefully will eventually become law that will put some real teeth into the enforcement of these policies.
And there was a particular case that had some impact here, as I understand it, the one about the use of antidepressants in adolescents and young people. Is that correct?
There is real concern that certain antidepressant drugs, while controlling depression, may actually increase the risk of suicide. And there was concern that a clinical trial that may have demonstrated that, the results were actually not made public.
Well, let's just cite a case here. If someone were to come to your journal with a spectacular study, a well-designed double-blind trial that might, say, come up with a cure for cancer, are you saying you wouldn't publish it if you didn't know about it ahead of time?
Yes, the answer is yes. When the policy goes into full effect, the international group of medical editors have agreed that they will not publish an unregistered clinical trial in their journal.
No matter what it is.
No matter what it is.
Your editorial about this also mentions the role of patients who volunteer for this research. What's your concern there?
Well, when patients enroll in a clinical trial, they assume certain risks. They're making a very positive contribution to the medical community and to wider society. And they do so with the understanding that the information obtained from the trial is going to be put to some kind of medical use and not buried away in a drug company's file someplace. So it's grossly unfair to patients who put themselves forward and make the sacrifice to be in a trial if the data never see the light of day.
Dr. Kerfman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gail.
Dr. Gregory Kerfman is the executive editor of the New England Journal of Medicine in Boston. Just ahead, Russian President Vladimir Putin has pledged to strike back after last week's horrific school hostage taking. But where will he strike? And later in the program, Intelligence Matters, Senator Bob Graham's new book on his misgivings about the Iraq War.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In Russia, the Kremlin is still trying to find its political footing after last week's schoolyard hostage taking. The identity of the attackers is still unclear, but their cause was the separatist movement in Chechnya, which President Vladimir Putin pledged to resolve when he came to power 4 years ago. Now Putin is confronted with questions from his own people and other world leaders. We begin first in Russia with Guy Chazin of the Wall Street Journal. He's in Moscow. And Guy, the school attack, I'm sure, is still a raw wound there.
Well, yeah, the mood is very sour and very angry, I think. I mean, we're just getting the first results of a poll by a very respected polling agency, which is extremely interesting. It basically shows people have lost totally their faith in the law enforcement system. They feel that they've been completely betrayed by the police and the intelligence services, and that they are mainly to blame for this tragedy, even more so than the Chechen terrorists. One of the most extraordinary results of this poll is the answer to the question, Do you think that the Russian authorities and the security services can guarantee your security, the security of the citizens of Russia, and avert future terror attacks? And 77% of those who were asked said absolutely not. So that kind of conveys to you the sheer sort of distrust and contempt, in a way, that the security services are now held in Russia. It does seem that Putin himself has not suffered that much. His popularity poll ratings have not really been that severely dented by this.
So what does he do now?
Well, it's very difficult to know what he's going to do, because the thing is that he surrounded himself with a lot of loyalists, not really according to their particular competence or their appropriateness for the job. I don't think he's going to sack any of them. Instead, he's going to try and boost security, especially in the North Caucasus. But unfortunately, the material that he has to deal with is just so weak. It's just really not up to the task. Law enforcers in Russia are very badly paid. They're essentially corrupt and pretty incompetent. So as a result, it's difficult to see how security really will be tightened up across Russia.
Guy Chazan, who reports for The Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from Moscow. Guy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the hostage-taking has stunned Americans who are pouring into the Russian embassy to sign condolence cards and send relief. But how has last week's school tragedy affected U.S.-Russian relations? Celeste Wallander is a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. She joins us now. And Dr. Wallander, Vladimir Putin had a pretty testy rebuke for those in the West who said he should resolve the Chechen conflict diplomatically.
Yeah, he told a group of visiting journalists and analysts that the foreigners shouldn't be advising him to negotiate with terrorists, and he explicitly apparently asked, would they consider after September 11th it appropriate to have negotiated with Osama bin Laden?
Sit down and have tea with him, I think was one of the phrases he used. But what are U.S. officials saying? The Russian security chief recently reminded the world that Russia will go anywhere it wants to attack terrorists. How do U.S. diplomats respond to that kind of talk, and is there a danger of a Russian war on terror colliding with a U.S. war on terrorism?
Well, the United States is in a little bit of a pickle in responding to that kind of claim, the right to use preemptive action to strike out against terrorism anywhere, of course, because U.S. policy currently is that the United States has the right to act preemptively against threats to the United States without U.N. Security Council resolution approval or any kind of approval by the international community.
And isn't there a larger U.S. international concern here? Countries have long been concerned about what they see as unsecured nuclear weapons or nuclear material in Russia. Now we have these terrorist attacks. As horrific as they are, they're also a reminder that terrorists are in that region. How concerned is the U.S. that Russia might be looking outside of the country to address a problem that may exist more inside?
Well, it's clearly a very important issue, and for the last 4 years we've heard a lot about the connection of international terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. Some of those claims have been pretty implausible, but in Russia those claims may actually be rather more plausible. In fact, one of the actions that the Russian government took last week was to order Interior Ministry troops to increase their presence and to secure nuclear sites in response to the crisis in Beslan. So clearly someone in Russia was taking this seriously and thinking about it. But the consensus of experts is that there is enormous amount of material in Russia that is not secure and that could be at risk of being either proliferating through deliberate intent, through someone stealing it and selling it abroad, or now we really do have to face the real, very real problem of possibly Russia's infrastructure not being up to the task of securing those materials. And this is a major concern for the United States.
Just one last overarching thought. Is there a sense in Washington that perhaps the eye was taken off of Russia and perhaps focused elsewhere?
a lot of people who focus on Russia inside and outside the U.S. government, people in Washington, have been saying for some time that you cannot ignore the problem of Chechnya. The Russian government would like to tell us that this is a purely internal matter, although you may have noticed that this week that hasn't been the main line. The main line has been that this is an international issue, which I found interesting. All along they've been telling us to keep our nose out of Chechnya. Now they're saying, see, it's international. Well, it's a little of both, and that's the problem. It is pretty clear that the war in Chechnya has not been a major priority of U.S. policy. Reaching out to President Putin, developing a good relationship with him, not annoying him, if not getting his support on Iraq, at least not getting his explicit opposition on Iraq, certainly trying to develop an energy dialogue to try and get more Russian oil onto global markets to secure supplies but also to reduce prices, has been a quite explicit priority of the Bush administration. So I think it really is fair to say that Chechnya has been certainly not ignored by experts and not ignored in policy analysts' work, but sort of on the front burner of policy, yeah, it unfortunately has been neglected and now has reasserted itself.
Celeste Wallander is a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Dr. Wallander, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman is calling President Bush's recent decision to give budgetary control to a new intelligence czar a turning point, one that may help get legislation passed. Yesterday, President Bush overcame his objections to giving a national intelligence director power over spending. A Senate committee expects to start voting in 2 weeks on its plan to reform the nation's spy agencies.
Meantime, the Bush administration's deep ties, long-standing ties, with the Saudi royal family led it to cover up Saudi involvement in the September 11th attacks. Well, that's the explosive charge being leveled by Florida Senator Bob Graham. The senator, of course, is a former Democratic presidential candidate and a former co-chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He's also the author of a new book, Intelligence Matters. Senator, welcome.
Thank you very much, Gail.
Senator, you were reportedly furious that the White House blacked out 28 pages of the congressional inquiry into the 9/11 plot. What was in those pages exactly, and why were you furious?
I believe in the book outline compelling evidence that Saudi Arabia was assisting two of the terrorists who were living in San Diego, providing them with places to live, with Social Security cards, with flying lessons, and with a substantial amount of cash. The 28 pages that were in our final report, which was the section of the book that focused on the Saudi role, and I was furious that the American people were not given access to that information so that they could make a judgment as to the kind of reliable ally that Saudi Arabia was, and also be a force for reform of our intelligence community.
What do you make of the 9/11 Commission's claim that, in fact, one of the men you mentioned, Omar al-Bayoumi, who you believe was a Saudi spy, they say they interviewed him and they don't think he did have any terrorist ties?
Well, I hate to be skeptical, but they interviewed him in Saudi Arabia. I do not know this for a fact, but allegedly with a Saudi government official in the room. What would have been Bayoumi's incentive to want to admit that he had been a Saudi agent and in that position had been a primary factor in providing assistance to terrorists?
Do you think the FBI has not been able to unravel this, or does it not want to?
Or a third possibility is that they have not been allowed to. One of the most significant characters in this story of 9/11 is a retired university professor living in San Diego who had fallen onto hard times economically and to support himself had done a couple of things. One, he'd started taking in boarders. Number two, he had become a paid informant for the FBI. His job was to look after Saudis in San Diego who might have some plans adverse to U.S. interest. It happened that he befriended two of the terrorists, those who were living in San Diego, and that one of them, a man named Hazmi, ended up living with the paid FBI informant for 4 months. In spite of all that, the informant never told his case officer with the FBI about these two people and alleges that he never had an idea why they were in the United States. That all seemed very inexplicable to our committee, and we tried on a number of occasions to get access to this man and interview him, including issuing the only subpoena that we did throughout the hearings. The FBI refused to deliver the subpoena, and since they had him under protective custody, they were the only people who knew where he was and therefore could serve the subpoena. When we probed the FBI and asked them why they were acting in such a way, they sent us a letter dated November 18th of 2002, which contained this statement: the administration would not sanction a staff interview with the source, that's the paid informant, nor did the administration agree to allow the FBI to serve a subpoena or a notice of deposition on the source. So it appears as if the reticence to let us get access to this key witness came right out of the White House.
You also, in your book, tell a eyebrow-raising story about General Tommy Franks. I wonder if you'd share that one with us.
On February the 19th of 2002, just as we were getting our joint inquiry of 9/11 underway, I went to Central Command to get a briefing on the war in Afghanistan, which was about 4 months underway at that time. After the sort of standard military briefing, General Franks invited me to come into his office, did, and he said, we've stopped fighting a war on terrorism. We're now engaged in a manhunt, that we're totally focused on trying to locate Mullah Omar, the former head of the Taliban, and Osama bin Laden. He then went on to say that there were resources being diverted from Afghanistan, military and intelligence resources, to get ready for the war in Iraq. He then proceeded to describe what he would do in terms of the war on terror, which was to finish the war in Afghanistan and then move to other places where there were substantial al-Qaeda cells, such as Somalia and Yemen. He said, Iraq is a special case. Our intelligence there is very weak. There are Europeans who know more about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq than we do. I thought that the general was very prophetic in what he said. He was very candid in the facts that he was conveying to me, and it's very unfortunate that the administration didn't follow the direction of the general's remarks.
Mm. And was that conversation in February of 2002 one of the reasons why in October of that year you voted against the war resolution?
My primary reason for voting against the war in Iraq is that I thought the number one threat to kill Americans was not Saddam Hussein, but was al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, and we should have stayed on that war in Afghanistan until it was completed, and then make a judgment as to if there were any other evils that justified the use of military power.
Well, Senator, thank you so much.
Good. Thank you very much, Gail.
Senator Bob Graham is the former co-chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the author of Intelligence Matters. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Muslims speak out against terrorism by other Muslims.
Plus, on the eve of September 11th, we'll visit a town on Long Island to see how residents there are continuing to cope with what happened 3 years ago. That's tomorrow, but still to come today. They were shown on big silver projectors. You waited for the beep to change the image. We'll look back at grade school film strips.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
A lot of you responded to a statement we made last week when we said that Senator Zell Miller challenged presidential candidate John Kerry to a duel. Well, we received many phone calls like this one.
Hi, my name is Joe, and I just wanted to correct something I just heard, saying that Zell Miller challenged John Kerry to a duel. That's not what happened. It was in a hot discussion with Chris Matthews from MSNBC. That Zell said, I wish we were back in the time when I could challenge you to a duel. So I just wanted to make sure you had your facts straight, because we don't want to attribute anything to Zell Miller that he doesn't deserve.
During the Republican convention, we spoke with two parents who each lost sons in Iraq. One parent opposed the war, one supported it. Dr. Edwin Stickney of Billings, Montana writes, I laud you for your exquisitely balanced, fair, nuanced presentation of the conflicting views of the parents of soldiers killed in Iraq. It's too bad Republicans can't be similarly motivated.
Vicki Meager of New Hampshire was dismayed that we started our week off with an editor of Newsweek magazine to talk about Bush's big bounce out of the Republican National Convention.
I just wanted to let you know, before you make too much about the so-called big lead that Bush has over Kerry in the Time and Newsweek polls, there are polls that are more accurate, and they show about a 2 to 4 point difference between Bush and Kerry.
Well, Wendy Heller of Plaistow, New Hampshire, also took issue with the poll results and the way the polling was conducted. Wendy writes, out of a sample size of 1,008 people, a total of 417 were military. This number is 41% of the sample, which is a much higher representation of the military than the percentage of the military in the voting public. Wendy goes on to write, the number of the over 50 population was more than 50% of the poll total, and they also do not constitute over 50% of the population. Wendy's point, the military and older Americans tend to vote Republican, and she concludes, why you chose to report on such a flawed poll escapes me, when the real story was the faulty methodology employed by Newsweek's polling.
And finally, last week we spoke with 16-year-old Christina Brody of Silver Springs, Maryland, who had written an article in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution saying she felt ostracized by other black kids because she liked school. We pointed out that she wasn't that far from Washington, D.C., where Howard University is located, and asked, aren't there places where being young, gifted, and black are rewarded? Which prompted Jeff Calabrese of Tucson to write, you avoided the fact that her own state of Maryland has a high-profile black lieutenant governor who was a key speaker at the Republican convention, and that Maryland is no Alabama. You carried the conversation as though she were in Mississippi in 1950 and not the near Northeast in 2004.
As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Well, tonight's NFL kickoff game will be a rematch between last season's Super Bowl champs, the New England Patriots, and the Indianapolis Colts. And it will be the NFL's first big return to national TV since January's Super Bowl costume debacle starring Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake. Well, NFL organizers are taking no chances. They're going to be asking the notoriously racy Britney Spears and her colleague Jessica Simpson to don more conservative costumes. Joining us on the line from St. Louis is Sporting News executive editor John Rawlings. And John, tonight's pregame will be the first major live broadcast of the NFL since last year's halftime show. So how else is the NFL preparing besides asking everyone to wear paper bags?
I can guarantee you there will be no malfunctions on the wardrobe side. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things is that ABC and the NFL has each inserted 5-second delay. So there will be a 10-second delay between the time things happen on the field and those of us outside of the field see it on TV.
We understand the FCC voted to fine 20 CBS stations that aired that wardrobe malfunction a total of $550,000 this week.
Yeah, that's real money where I come from. And I think it's a reflection, Robin, of how I think our culture is pretty conservative right now, and the social values are changing a little bit, and it really was galvanized by Janet Jackson and her quick exposure.
Well, you know, you say it's a politically charged time. The NFL is saying that the show is going to be less politically charged, but they've lined up performers such as Toby Keith, who sings the song courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, The Angry American, and Britney Spears, who's on the record saying she supports President Bush.
Well, keep in mind that the NFL is a brand. It's an entertainment. They've got the hardcore football fans. They are looking to expand their base. And particularly, I think right now the way to do that is to wear the red, white, and blue mm-hmm. and wave the flag and line up behind those things that seem to be popular. And the NFL's very good at reading that.
Yeah. And by the way, with all of this hoopla in the pregame, an actual game might break out.
I think it's going to be a great game. It's a rematch, of course, of last year's AFC Championship game. The one big thing to watch for is will the NFL apply its new rules that tells the Patriots defensive backs, you've got to let the receivers get off the ball. And every NFL fan who watches for the football will be watching for that.
Well, John, no. The thing to watch for is to see how the New England Patriots will once again roll over the Colts.
You know, the NFL has set out to not let that happen. We'll see.
John Rawlings, executive editor of the Sporting News. John, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to do it.
People of a certain age might remember back in elementary school. The teacher would dim the lights, pull down the shades. Someone would be snagged to run the projector. And then...
Do you know what Mark is waiting for? Is it a ride on a pony or a rocket to the moon? No. He's waiting for the school bus to take him to school.
Well, and then... Everyone promptly fell asleep. Well, not everyone. Writer Danny Gregory says that film strips fascinated him. They were the way he learned what America was. He has a new book out called Change Your Underwear Twice a Week, and he joins us from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York to tell us about it. Hi, Danny.
Hello.
To the title first, Change Your Underwear Twice a Week?
Yes. That refers to one of the lessons from one of the film strips in the book.
Oh, it just is resonating so for me. I think I saw the one about learning how to sleep on your mat and walking down the hall and staying on the right-hand side.
Yes, well, hopefully all Americans learn that so we can all function smoothly as a society.
How would we work our way through halls without it? Well, where did you first see these film strips?
The very first time that I saw them was when I was about 9 years old. And I wasn't living in the United States at that time. I was... living in Pakistan, actually, and I was going to the Lahore American School. While I was there one day in class, the teacher showed us a film strip about a boy who grew up on a farm. And it was this very sort of, to me, very romantic vision of what it would be like to be in America, to be sort of a cowboy's kids growing up on a farm surrounded by cows and dogs, and it was all very brightly colored and vivid. That memory was sort of, I guess, deep inside me, although I'd kind of forgotten it. Yeah, until a couple of years ago, I was at a flea market in New York City, and I happened to come upon a large collection of these educational film strips, and it brought this memory back to me that I'd kind of forgotten for a while.
Oh, I'm sure people are being flooded with memories as we speak of those dark green shades being pulled down in the classroom to keep the light out, and the canister of the film projector itself with the little feet that came down. For those who haven't heard them, let's listen to a little bit more of one. This is called Phone Manners.
Yeah, this is a film strip that's later. It's probably from the early 70s, and it kind of lives up to its name. Let's hear a track.
There is a wonderful thing in your house. It lets you talk to your friends in the rain without getting wet. It lets you talk to someone far away without having to shout.
Hey, Louis!
I'm sure you guessed what it is. It's your telephone. Except, of course,
I feel as if some of my brain cells were just killed. But in fact, for a child, you know, these film strips were stunningly simple.
That's what they're designed to do. They're really designed to be a discussion point for a classroom.
I want to listen to another one. It was about how to behave and how to live and how to be. Let's listen to Hey, Don't Push. This one's about cafeteria manners.
It's time for lunch. And we're all going to the school cafeteria. Eating lunch with your friends and classmates can be lots of fun. But there are some things to think about when you're eating with others.
I'm looking also, Danny, at the Drink Your Milk, Nap on Your Mat chapter in your book.
Good manners are
We Go to School was a series of films so that kids could learn how to go to school, what to eat. Don't put pencils up your nose. Which one is that?
That's a very important lesson. that's probably in the health and hygiene section. It's called Keeping Well and Happy. It was actually a film strip from your local tuberculosis association.
As you were collecting these and looking at these, and in your book you lay out a lot of the scenes from the films, what were you seeing take shape? What was forming in front of you?
Well, what I was really interested to find out was, why were we being taught a lot of these things? Why did somebody think it was worth making a film strip, for instance, about standing up straight? I think there were a lot of things that were going on. Most of these film strips go from probably the late 30s up until the early 70s. And particularly in the 1950s, there were just so many cultural shifts that were happening. For one thing, kids were being encouraged to stay in school for much longer than they had in the past. It was really in the 1930s that they realized that if you allow kids to leave school in the eighth grade, they're going to become competition in the labor force. So if there's a way of keeping them in high school,
right,
you know, that would be great. But a very small percentage of kids actually went on to college. It was in the sort of 5 to 10% range. So what are you going to teach all these kids for all these years? Suddenly, the agenda has to change. The curriculum has to change.
One of the key jobs in metalworking is that of a welder. A welder joins metal parts by applying heat, pressure, or both to achieve a permanent bond.
Progressive education was also changing the way the role of schools. It wasn't just there to teach you to read and write and to do arithmetic, the basics. But there was a sense that school was there also to fulfill children's lives.
Just a quick look through the book, and again, you have all these great pictures of panels from the films. Some of them acted out with dolls, some of them, most of them with real people, all of them white.
That's true. There's really the only African American person that's in the book is a film strip on law enforcement, and somebody's had an accident. But
I wonder, as I look at this, if there are children who looked at these films and in other ways said, "Yeah, I don't know that world, that perfect world that's being taught to me up on that film strip."
Yeah, well, there was definitely a movement towards homogeneity. Some of the film strips from the 60s and 70s show more culturally diverse schools. But by and large, they were trying to, I think, make things feel sort of solid, consistent, reliable, unvarying.
Well, Danny Gregory, your book is called Change Your Underwear Twice a Week, Lessons from the Golden Age of Classroom Film Strips. Danny, thanks.
Thank you.
The use of metals is rapidly increasing, especially in construction, manufacturing, and transportation industries. Growth in the use of
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris.
Wait for the beep. I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
It's the welder's job to join metal parts by applying heat.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.